It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The U.S. backs the new Iraqi offensive against the IS-held city of Ramadi. President Obama Tuesday met with his national security team, reaffirming strong U.S. support for Iraq's Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi, and a new offensive being prepared by paramilitary forces to recapture the city of Ramadi from Islamic State insurgents. White House spokesman Josh Earnest cautioned there will be successes and setbacks in the strategy to degrade and destroy the IS group.
We've seen that there are no quick fixes involved. There's been important progress that's been made, but there have also been periods of setback. And certainly the ISIL effort to take over Ramadi is a setback.
A U.S. defense spokesman said the attempt to reclaim the Anbar provincial capital became more challenging when Iraqi security forces abandoned a vast array of U.S. military equipment as they fled the city in the face of Sunday's onslaught by the IS group. In Burundi, more street demonstrations against President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid to seek a third term in next month's election. Protesters defied warnings to end weeks of demonstrations. Security forces used tear gas and beatings to clear the streets of the capital Bujumbura Tuesday. At least 20 have died in 3 weeks of clashes between security forces and protesters who say Mr. Nkurunziza's ambitions violate the country's constitution. The president withstood a coup attempt last week when he was out of the country for a regional conference focused on Burundi's political situation. On Monday, a summit of African Great Lakes region countries called on Burundi to postpone the June 26 election until the country is stable. This is VOA News. The United Nations is intensifying pressure on Southeast Asian countries that have been reluctant to come to the rescue of thousands of refugees and migrants stranded at sea following a crackdown on human traffickers. Indonesia, Malaysia, and Thailand have come under criticism for turning away migrant boats in recent days, fearful their shores will be overwhelmed if the refugees from Myanmar and Bangladesh are allowed to disembark. Peter McCauley is a Southeast Asian analyst with the Australian National University. He spoke from Manila.
There's a large group, some hundreds of thousands, perhaps a million people, refugees. The figures are not entirely clear. And they're a combination of people from short-term, from Bangladesh, who've crossed the border, and also longer-term people, the Rohingyas, who have been in Burma or Myanmar, as we call it, for a generation or so. Now, there are these large camps on the border between the two countries, and they're really not accepted by either country.
Nearly 3,000 of the so-called boat people have been rescued or made their way to shore over the past week. Thousands more are believed to be drifting at sea with little or no supplies. Many of the migrant boats were abandoned by human traffickers after a Thai crackdown on a vast people-smuggling ring. Macedonia's Prime Minister Nikola Gruevski and main opposition leader Zoran Zaev began talks mediated by European Union officials in an attempt to find a solution to the crisis in the country. Pressure on Mr. Gruevski has been building since a wiretapping scandal broke earlier this year, prompting questions about how tightly the government controls the media, judges, and elections. Thorbjørn Jagland is Secretary General of the Council of Europe.
It is, of course, strong need for impartial, trustful investigation on what has happened with regard to the claims that there has been massive wiretapping of citizens of Macedonia. One has to find the truth there in order to move forward.
The United States has called on all sides of the Macedonian conflict to, quote, respect the rights of freedom of assembly and the peaceful protest and refrain from violence. At least 8 people killed when a suicide bomber blew himself up outside a livestock market in Garkita in Nigeria's northeast Adamawa state. This latest attack, about 165 kilometers north of the state capital Yola, followed a similar assault on a village in the state's Madagali district in which 3 were killed and several women kidnapped. Boko Haram has been on the defensive since a joint military operation involving troops from Nigeria, Niger, Chad, and Cameroon have pushed the insurgents out of northern villages that they have occupied. The U.S. Justice Department has charged 6 Chinese nationals with economic espionage and theft of trade secrets for allegedly accessing secret U.S. technologies and sharing them with universities and companies controlled by China. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ethiopia's going to the polls this Sunday to elect a new government, but how will the opposition fare this time out compared to the last election?
The land is owned by the government. If they stood against, you know, the government, they think that they will lose their land. When it comes to the urban area, it is the government who, you know, employ, you know, people, you know. Most of the houses are owned by the government.
That's opposition leader Ledetu Ayeliu. The WHO asks for vigilance as Ebola is still a risk in West Africa. Zimbabwe's labor and business leaders debate a government proposal to introduce a national health insurance system. And the United Nations says South Sudan children have been killed, raped and abducted.
A clear picture has emerged of widespread child rights abuses that constitute serious violations of international law. This includes widespread sexual violence against women and girls and the killing and maiming of children.
Jonathan Vich is the UNICEF's representative in South Sudan. A UN representative discusses Somalia's 2016 presidential election and will visit South Africa's Museum of Money. Those stories, plus Mark Omar's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ethiopians go to the polls this Sunday to elect a new government. This will be the country's fifth national election. In the 2010 elections, the government opened up the political arena, but when the United Opposition received more votes than the ruling party expected, the government was accused of stealing back the elections and mass demonstrations against the final results turned violent. Now that there is a new prime minister, what do the opposition leaders from 10 years ago expect in Sunday's elections? Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
During Ethiopia's 2005 elections, political parties campaigned freely and held lively debates with little or no government interference. The country's mood, however, turned sour after the elections. When results were delayed, the government claimed victory and protesters took to the streets. Clashes between demonstrators and police led to the deaths of nearly 200 people. Haile Shawul was an opposition leader for the All Ethiopia Unity Party in 2005 and 2010. He says the political environment changed radically after the 2005 vote.
They wouldn't let anybody campaign, really. Before they start, they block your road. Before you start, they cancel your meeting. So even the election process was so skewed. The papers were already marked. So where is the election?
Hailu, together with many other opposition leaders, was imprisoned for 2 years after they decided not to take their seats in parliament as they felt the government had stolen the elections. Opposition leader Ledetu Ayeliu contested the 2005 election with EDP, the Ethiopia Democratic Party, and is still on its national board. He says he feels the government always tried to win through intimidation, but changed its target after 2005.
You know, 5-10 years ago, you know, the strategy of, you know, the ruling party was intimidating, you know, the candidates. Now that has been changed, you know, since 2010. So they tried to, you know, intimidate, you know, the voters by going, you know, in every part of the country.
The 2010 vote ended with opposition parties holding only a single seat in parliament. Ledetu says it is easy for the government to influence the population as many Ethiopians are directly dependent on the government for their livelihoods.
So the land is owned by the government. If they stood against, you know, the government, they think that they will lose their land. When it comes to the urban area, it is the government who, you know, employ, you know, people, you know, in a mass, you know. The private sector is not that much, you know, vibrant. Most of the houses are owned by the government. So those people who are living there, they're highly, you know, vulnerable for government influence.
The ruling party has denied any allegations of systematic intimidating opposition parties, members and supporters. Over 36 million Ethiopians have registered to vote this Sunday. The only international observers present will be from the African Union. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Health ministers and officials attending the World Health Assembly in Geneva are urging continued vigilance until the Ebola epidemic is completely stopped in West Africa. The assembly has called on the international community to maintain its commitment to defeating the deadly virus, which has killed more than 11,000 people in the region. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the conference in Geneva.
The Director General of the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, kicked off a panel discussion on Ebola on a cheery note.
Yes, we celebrated big success in Liberia on the 9th of May, right? Keep up with the good work, Liberia. We are, as I said, at a very critical stage. And this is a qualified victory in the sense because the country remains at risk of reinfection from its neighbors.
The WHO's latest report shows Sierra Leone and Guinea had 35 new cases of Ebola last week. That is four times higher than the week before. The implied threat in this message was not lost on Miata Gibanya, a senior official in Liberia's Ministry of Health.
When a disease hits your neighbor's front door, beware that it could come to your back door. So we have embarked on cross-border collaboration with Guinea and Sierra Leone, as well as Ivory Coast, because we countries need to start to talk to each other. We need to start to share information. We need to share knowledge and skills.
Health ministers from all three West African countries agreed continued vigilance, increased surveillance, and strong political will are needed to bring Ebola cases down to zero. They also spoke about the need to intimately involve communities in every aspect of an ongoing emergency or potential health emergency. Klaus Sorensen is Director General of the European Commission's Humanitarian Aid Department, known as ECHO. He, as well as other participants, spoke about the need for the WHO to reform its structure so that it can respond more quickly to health emergencies.
What I'm fishing for is an effective organization inside the organization, which is empowered to actually have a look at all the hazards, that is, has a capacity of giving us forward warning, that you are capable of effectively supporting the clusters in all the different humanitarian catastrophe situations that unfortunately are facing us around the world.
Sorensen says one emergency leads to another, so that a health emergency will likely lead to a breakdown of food market systems, water and sanitation, and protection services. He says the WHO should have the capacity to oversee and help coordinate solutions to these problems as well. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says dozens of children in South Sudan's Unity State have been killed, raped, and abducted during the past 2 weeks by armed groups. Mugumi Davis Rakarinji of VOA South Sudan in Focus program has the story from Juba.
UNICEF's South Sudan country director, Jonathan Vietch, says UNICEF investigators discovered that many children have been abused and at least 19 youth have been killed in recent clashes.
A clear picture has emerged of widespread child rights abuses that constitute serious violations of international law. This includes widespread sexual violence against women and girls and the killing and maiming of children, and also the forced recruitment of children into armed groups.
VH says his team recorded testimony from people who described inhuman acts committed during the latest wave of violence.
Somebody called Teresa, who's 27 years old, she said to us that when we ran away, we heard that they were taking women and children. Children over 12 were killed. I saw some children killed. I have three brothers, 13, 14, and 25 years old, and they all went to the north because they knew they would be killed if they came to Bentiu. The soldiers were shouting that they were going to kill them. They said that they were going to kill all of the young men and all of the boys.
Aid workers say it is even more difficult to provide support for people who have fled into the bush. Unfortunately, VH says children have been both the victims and perpetrators of the recent violence. He says some boys and girls as young as 10 have been mutilated or recruited to join the fighting and care for stolen cattle. VH says UNICEF is engaging both the government and the opposition to stop the abuse of innocent children.
They're giving assurances and they're going to look into the situation. So we look forward to that investigation. It's very important that any crimes like this are investigated and that we stop these grave violations against children. But the most important thing is to stop the fighting right now and to enable humanitarians to access all populations wherever they are in South Sudan.
UNICEF says it has received more than 1,700 former child soldiers from former Kobla militia factions since the beginning of the year. They hope to reunite all those children with their families. But that number does not come close to the thousands of children who have become child soldiers. VH estimates at least 13,000 children have been recruited by all parties involved in the conflict. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
Today's Wednesday, May 20th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe's labor and business leaders say they are opposed to a government proposal to introduce a national health insurance system similar to the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare in the United States. The country's labor minister tabled the proposal at the tripartite negotiations forum, which is discussing ways to create an enabling economic and social vision. Reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe Service spoke with Japhet Moyo, Secretary General of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions, and John Mufukuraya, President of the Employers' Confederation of Zimbabwe.
It is extremely significant, because what we have always said is that our problems will only be solved once we start talking to each other. Now, the mere fact that the TNF has resumed might itself not be the solution we want, because we can talk at each other rather than talk to each other. What we saw on the ground yesterday was very encouraging. It appears we are now in a position where we can talk to each other. And I'm hopeful that if this continues, then maybe we are at the beginning of the solution of our problems.
Mr. Moyo, are you of the same opinion about the TNF?
Yes. Our view is that if we talk, if we always talk, if we always engage, we are likely to find each other. We have differences. But if we keep on talking on issues, our view is that we'll be able to get a solution out of our challenges.
We understand that the government wants to introduce a national health insurance scheme. What is your take on that?
We think this is definitely the wrong timing for that initiative. We agree with the initiative in principle. But what we are saying now is, in a situation where companies cannot even cope with the current social protection services that are required through NASA, that is the pension scheme, it is not very practical that you want to put more on somebody who cannot even afford the little that is on them at the moment.
Mr. Moyo, is this not going to benefit labor?
Our challenge, I think, is the idea is based on a study done about 25 years ago. And as workers, we felt that we need to look at the current environment. We have challenges as workers. We go without our salaries for longer periods. Even when our employers are able to make that deduction, our employers sometimes are unable to make that remittance to the respective institutions, so it might not be able to assist us at all. We also have a challenge with the governance issues, the issues of governance and transparency within NASA.
That was Secretary General Japhet Moyo of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions. You also heard from John Mufukuraya, President of the Employers' Confederation of Zimbabwe. The Special Representative of the United Nations Secretary General for Somalia says he's optimistic Somalia will have its 2016 elections. Ambassador Nicholas Kay says he's encouraged by the current government's commitment to the process.
I think what is very clear and very encouraging is that there's an absolute commitment from the President and others to respecting the term which expires for Parliament in August and the President in September 2016. Now, you know, what kind of process will select the next Parliament and that, then the next President? That will be determined by Somalis, and the body that's supposed to do that is the National Independent Electoral Commission, which has not yet been established. It's very urgent that that commission is established and then tells us and the international community and Somalis what is the art of the possible in terms of an election on that time frame.
Though AMISOM and Somali forces have liberated many parts of Somalia from Shabab, Shabab is still able to cause mayhem in Mogadishu and elsewhere. What are the major security challenges preventing AMISOM and Somali forces from defeating al-Shabaab?
Yeah, al-Shabaab have been pushed out of a lot of territory. Unfortunately, there are still significant areas that they do control. And I think it's very important that there should be a deliberate military operation that against those areas. And that, I think, is very much the intention of the African Union, the Somali National Army, to do that. As we all know, I mean, defeating and removing a terrorist threat is a complicated process. It's a long process. It's very easy for groups to use suicide bombers to plant roadside bombs and other such sort of terrorist tactics. So it'll be a while before we see the complete end of that.
Following the Garissa University attack in northeastern Kenya, the Kenyan government authorized building a wall along Somali-Kenya border. Do you think such an idea is a wise, and do you think such a wall would prevent further attacks from Shabaab?
Obviously, you know, how any country manages its border is very much a matter for itself and its own sovereign decisions. So I wouldn't really comment directly on that. What I would say is that we are working very closely as United Nations with the government of Kenya and the government of Somalia in terms of helping to manage the refugee.
Ambassador Nicholas Kay is the special representative of the United Nations Secretary General for Somalia. He was speaking from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, with Mohamed Olat of VOA Somali Service. Where else but Johannesburg, a city built on the back of a gold rush and home to Africa's major stock exchange, would there be a monument to money? The Museum of Money is in a building belonging to the international banking group Barclays in the center of South Africa's biggest metropolis. Darren Taylor has more.
The beauty of money is you're dealing with items that have been used, and each coin has a history. It was in someone's hand. It was used for something.
Money Museum curator Dr. Paul Bayliss strolls past glass cabinets holding thousands of coins, from faded, chipped brass guilders brought to South Africa by Dutch settlers in the 1600s to dull, dark Portuguese coins recovered from a shipwreck off the Cape Coast in the 1400s.
Very large and almost unwieldy to work with when you think of currencies from most countries that now need to fit into your pocket.
Most old coins are big and very heavy. Bayliss holds one.
It's got a hole in the middle, allowing someone to put a bit of leather twine through that, hang it around their neck. It's not something you would really have carried in your pocket because of the weight.
The museum provides a record of the history of money dating back 4,500 years to when people exchanged commodities such as shells. Bayliss says ancient people bartered with anything they considered to be of value.
If we think of the San people, the ostrich eggshell was also quite an important item because that could be used for carrying water or storing water as they migrated.
The historian says the discovery of diamonds and gold in the mid to late 1800s had the greatest impact on the evolution of money in South Africa.
That brought in a whole new group of people into the country, and particularly then you would then also see the variety of coins that I will show you in the vault.
Inside the vault, overhead lights cause hundreds of brilliant coins to gleam. Armed security officers hover nearby, protecting the valuable collection. Inside are examples of some of the most famous coins in the world, South African Kruger Rands, made of pure gold. The coins bear the image of the long-bearded face of Paul Kruger, president of the South African Republic in the late 1800s.
The advantage of a Kruger Rand, it allows any individual to own a piece of gold. And from an investment perspective, it allows you to invest in actual gold.
One of the more unusual exhibits in the museum is what Bayliss calls canvas sack money, used during the Anglo-Boer War of 1899 to 1902. But in assembling one of the greatest collections of money in the world, sourced from all over the globe, the impossible is exactly what Bayliss and his colleagues have achieved. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma from Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Zimbabwe pipped Seychelles by a solitary goal as Namibia beat Mauritius 2-0 in Group A action at the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup preliminaries at the Royal Bafokeng Sports Palace in Pokeng, Northwest Province in South Africa on Tuesday. Consequently, Zimbabwe lead the Group A with 6 points. Namibia has 4, Seychelles 1, while Mauritius has no point. Today, Wednesday, attention shifts to Group B, where guest side Tanzania challenge Madagascar, then Lesotho and Swaziland face off. Swaziland and Madagascar won their opening group encounters. In Lebanon, Algerian referee Jamel Haimoudi was awarded the 2014 Golden Whistle Award, the Lebanese magazine Al Hadath Al Riyadi revealed in Beirut. Haimoudi retired after serving at the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil. The award is conferred to the best football referee in the Arab world each year. In the poll conducted by the publication, Moroccan Ridouane Achille was ranked the second best assistant referee among the 39 active match officials in the Arab world. Meanwhile, Belgian Tom Saintfiet has been confirmed as a Togo football coach, the Togo Football Federation head Antoine Foley told the media in Lomé. The Belgian tactician, who was a caretaker coach when Togo played Mauritius in a friendly in March, will guide Togo in their 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifying campaign. Staying with matters coaching, Raoul Savoy of Switzerland is the new coach for the Gambia national team. The Gambia Football Association head Lamine Kaba Bajo revealed in Banjul. His main task is to qualify the Scorpions for their quest to make their maiden appearance at the Nations Cup. Finally, in motorsports, following his triumph at the Zambia International Rally in Lusaka on Sunday, Kenyan Jaspreet Singh Chatte has amassed 50 points and after three events in the 2015 Africa Rally Championship Series. After three rallies this year in Ivory Coast, South Africa and Zambia, Jesse Singh of Zambia is lying second with 36 points, while Zimbabwean Muna Singh Jr. is third with 30 points. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, May 20th.
The ongoing hostilities in Burundi is a clear indication that President Nkurunziza is no longer the interest of the masses. Therefore, he should honorably step down. Otherwise, his election shall never be free and fair. I am Prince John Ushie in Obudu Katoranch, Cross River State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. That's it for this Wednesday, May 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Button in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOA News.